You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters.
Hello, you beautiful people. Table Talk is a guide to the future of food and nutrition, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we chat with visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will transform our food landscape. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a broadcaster, and I'm a gastronaut. Often, we start the podcast with a sentence referencing the year 2050 as some crucial moment in time, often based on the imminent increase of global population or net zero global emissions. So it's really exciting to champion 2040 for once, woo! Because that's the commitment the Food and Drink Federation has made to reduce carbon emissions from the food and drink industry to net zero 10 years ahead of the national target. Sounds like great news, but why is this important to achieve, and is it overly optimistic? Today we're going to discuss how that's going to be achieved. What are the innovations that will get packaging and manufacturing, ingredients, distribution, all of the bits of the food chain ready to hit that target in about 18 years and 167 days. With me are Emma Pearcey, Head of Climate Change and Energy Policy at the Food and Drink Federation. Hello there, Emma.
Hello.
And also Matt Luce, Chief Executive and Founder of Canopy Consulting. Hello there, Matt.
Hello.
And for full disclosure, I believe you're working together on a project at the moment. Is that right?
It is indeed. Really happy to be working with Matt and also colleagues from 3Keel on our roadmap to net zero, which I'm sure will feature in our conversation today.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, obviously, neither of you are going to disagree with each other, so I'm going to try and throw some brickbats in there for you instead. Now, Emma, we last talked about this topic about a year ago, and a lot's changed, but net zero still means the same thing, doesn't it? Can you just tell us, what's the overall aim of this?
Well, I think with COP26 coming up shortly, so coming up in November, there is a lot of focus also around food. So globally, emissions, global greenhouse gas emissions from food account for about 26% of the footprint. So when we think about the impact that the sector is having, it is huge. And so it is taking, quite rightly so, sort of centre stage. So that's why it's of increasing importance to the agenda. And I think when we look at the stakeholders from across the farm to fork value chain, we see that we're all sort of coalescing around the urgency and the need to take action and make progress towards these targets. And so that's what we've seen a lot of over the last year, and you know, that we're talking about today.
And now 2050 sounds like a long way away. Certainly if you're a politician, you kind of think, I'll chuck these dates out because I'm not going to be around anyway. And who knows what's going to happen between then and now. But the food industry is a different beast, isn't it? And planning has to happen. So suddenly you're talking about a new date of 2040. Now, before we get into the detail of all this, why did you decide on 2040?
Well, I think the first thing is about showing ambition and about showing that motivation, that commitment to making change, because of course we can all talk about targets in the future, but what really matters, I think, right now and in the short term is about creating actions. So by having a 2040 target or ambition, you know, it's actually about building that momentum and that need for action now to get us on that pathway. And so by the food and drink agreeing to a 2040 ambition, that actually brings us across that farm to fork supply chain to that common goal of 2040, because we see the NFU also have a 2040 ambition, the BRC have a 2040 ambition, and what that means, you know, is that they want to see net zero products on their shelves by 2040. So you know, we as manufacturers working with the farmers, you know, we need to deliver that. So now we'll all be working together to those same goals.
Okay. Now, Matt, you work with organisations to implement sustainability strategies and help people actually pull this kind of thing off. Now, 2050 for the food industry was pretty close already. You know, the people were kind of going, okay, we better get down to it. 2040 is, there must have been a global intake of breath and a whole lot of people saying, holy crap, we really need to get down to this. Are there going to be difficulties? And what do you think your clients make of this shift?
Mm-hmm. I think, as Emma said, 2040 is certainly ambitious. I think there's some really good reasons to believe it's possible, though. And certainly if you look at the pace of grid decarbonisation in the UK, there's real hopes that we can decarbonise our electric supply very, very quickly. And that's going to make all sorts of things possible, from decarbonising manufacturing plants to decarbonising transport to decarbonising on-farm machinery. We're also seeing already some very interesting shifts in what people eat, and the growth opportunities around plant-based diets at the moment are, I think, really exciting for food manufacturers. So there's some reasons to believe change can and will happen really quickly. At the same time, I think it's right to acknowledge some really substantial challenges ahead. And what we're observing with clients is a willingness to set these longer term ambitions, and acceptance and indeed encouragement for those ambitions from investors and employees and customers. And we're seeing those long-term ambitions already biting in terms of immediate large business decisions. So I think whilst 2040 may seem a long way off for people, capital investment decisions that you're making today about your infrastructure and your manufacturing facilities, for example, you'll be living with until 2040. So it becomes an immediate business imperative to act.
Okay, so just so I understand this correctly, it seems as though the wind is behind us a little bit, that there's a combination of factors, things like the sudden expansion of wind energy and the achievements of the electricity industry, but also the growth of plant-based food, the food sector, which helps again. Are there other issues that make this a particular moment in time where everyone's said, hang on, we can achieve this and we can achieve this early? What are the other sort of elements that are going to help get there earlier?
I think I'll just touch upon again COP26, which for us in the UK is helping build that momentum. Mm. And it really helps to focus minds, because when it's taking place in your country, you want to be able to talk and demonstrate about the progress that your sector is making. And so that's really focused our minds. So that's one thing. I think the second thing relates to this COVID pandemic, and that, you know, from sort of last year, we've started talking about a green recovery. So as we go through this pandemic and start to rebuild our economies, that we try to do so in a green way. And I think that those two things kind of coalescing, COVID and COP26 in that way, really has brought some of these issues to the fore.
So it's about the inspiration as much as the tools at our disposal.
Yeah. Yes. It's like different parts of a jigsaw coming together to build that momentum.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And of course, COP26 is only one point in time. You know, then it's about us continuing to build on that. But we see a lot coming from government too, which I know we'll touch upon, which is all supportive of this. So it's every stakeholder playing their part, which is building that momentum.
Okay, Matt, well, let's touch on that right now then. Supportive government. What are you seeing that is helping the food and drink industry?
Well, as you started in your introduction, really, this goes right the way across the farm-to-fork value chain. So you can point at government interventions right across that, from work to try and eliminate deforestation from supply chains, which, of course, is a massive driver of carbon emissions, to industrial heat strategies, to the recent news about transportation and starting to lay out a vision for decarbonising. One of the sort of real challenging areas is around heavy goods vehicles and what technology pathway we're going to land on with HEVs. And there's some very good news in terms of government signals for industry to invest in innovation to get carbon out of the HGV logistics network.
Can you give us some specifics about that, the good news that you just mentioned?
I think a 2040 target for all HEVs to be zero emissions from that date forward, all new HEVs. And that's a great signal that that kind of technology will be on the market and will be an opportunity for the food and drink sector to move logistics onto that pathway. So,
are we talking hydrogen as the main fuel, or are we thinking electric lorries, which seems a little far-fetched?
Yeah, I think it's unsure which path we're going to go down as things stand. Mm. Some of the technologies include, as you say, some sort of hydrogen fuel cell type technologies. But one of the popular ones that people are talking about at the moment is running electric trucks with the pantographs over the top of the vehicle, which can then run on electric wires, basically, around major routes in the UK. So there's a number of different technology options that people are trialing and experimenting and considering in terms of investment opportunities.
I'll just think to add to that is, I suppose it's a common phrase where there isn't going to be a one-size-fits-all. Mm. It's going to be a mix, I think, of these technologies. And again, a difference perhaps between sort of local distribution and then the long haul as well.
Yeah.
And whether you're talking about, you know, between those major sort of cities or in the countryside and more dispersed areas.
And different tools are going to be used for different jobs. So, Emma, what are the easiest parts of the industry to get to net zero? And which are the sticking points? Where are the tricky bits?
Well, I think for food and drink manufacturers, the part of the carbon footprint, shall we say, that they can impact on most directly themselves is, of course, their own scope 1 and 2 emissions, their on-site emissions, effectively, the energy they're using on-site. Mm. So, you know, examples of that would be obviously with electricity usage and in their processes, generating, you know, heat and steam through boilers or through CHP. But those are the kind of examples, and basically how they can reduce their energy consumption and the energy that they're using, how that can be sort of taken to net zero. So that is an area where they have sort of direct impact or control. But should we say the unfortunate thing in this context is that actually when we look at the full carbon footprint from food and drink manufacturers, the scope 1 and 2 emissions accounts for roughly 10 to 15%. The majority of the carbon footprint is actually with the supply chain. Mm. And that is the scope 3 emissions. So that is the much bigger challenge. And so, you know, that is one of the reasons, well, that's the reason why, of course, you know, working with stakeholders across the farm to fork supply chain is critical to be able to start making impactful progress in that area. And there are a lot of industry initiatives that are growing in that area at the moment as well.
So can you give us a little bit more detail about scope 3? What's included within that?
Well, I'm just wondering, actually, Matt, this might be a better one for you to talk about. So I'll pass over to you in a moment. But for me, the key thing that comes to mind, actually, the biggest area is around ingredients. Mm. The ingredients that you use in your products, that is where you get the most sort of embodied carbon. But given that we're undertaking our roadmap to net zero at the moment, I shall pass on to Matt to comment on that question more.
Yeah, thanks, Emma. And so our colleagues at 3Keel, in conjunction with RAP, have been trying to run the numbers on the food and drink sector's carbon impact in the UK. And just a few headlines from that. Emma said that the ingredients piece was fundamentally important. So the UK agricultural footprint of the food and drink sector is about 39%, so nearly 40% of emissions come from UK agriculture. About 22%, so just over a fifth of all food and drink related emissions, are imported emissions associated with ingredients. So that's ingredients that are produced by manufacturers, by agriculture outside of the UK. About 4% of emissions come from packaging. If you think about what's within the direct control of a food and drink manufacturer and the manufacturing processes that they have, so that's the scope 1 and 2 emissions, as we might talk about it. That's just 6% of UK food and drink emissions. 5% is then transport related. 11% is associated with retail and catering operations. 12% sits with consumers and things like home cooking of products. And then about 1% is post-consumer, so waste disposal. Mm. So when you look at the emissions that are directly within the gift of food and drink manufacturers to own and influence, it's only 6% of a very large picture, as Emma was sketching.
Yeah. This also brings to mind the trickiness of the fact that a lot of this is dependent on things like a national infrastructure program, which is an element that's out of your hands. So we mentioned hydrogen fuel infrastructure. You talked about overhead electric cabling for powering vehicles. I'm thinking recharging networks for cars. Now, these are outside of the scope. They're not within your gift to control. Could this put the target of 2040 in jeopardy?
Yeah, so in terms of the dependence that I think food and drink manufacturers will have on others, in a sense, to build that necessary infrastructure. Clearly, I think in terms of hydrogen, that will be one aspect, because, of course, food and drink manufacturing is more in dispersed manufacturing sites, not in the industrial clusters. But that, I think, actually means for food and drink that actually we'll probably use more blended gas, hydrogen up to about 20% in the network potentially. So that relies on sort of government policy to be able to incentivize that. There will also be a reliance on, of course, necessary electricity grid infrastructure, especially as we're looking to move to more electrification, given the assumptions around the electricity grid decarbonising to net zero. So there is that dependence, but of course, that does mean that we very much need to work as an industry, but across other industrial sectors as well, within our sort of local regions, in area to area, communicating with DNOs, the distribution network operators, you know, the other key stakeholders who manage this infrastructure, to get that information across of what is needed. And I think Ofgem, in their work on sort of the business plans over the next 5-10 years, working with those stakeholders, are very much mindful of these developments that will take place. So I think it's very important that all key stakeholders are, you know, talk to each other, work together, and we are doing that. So communication, I think, is key, which is something we, you know, manufacturers can engage with. I think more broadly about the dependency on others to do things, it's not possible to give responsibility to one party. And so as an example around looking at how to calculate supply chain emissions, I mean, as one example, we are all convening with RAP in terms of the different stakeholders across the farm to fork value chain, coming together to look at how we can create an aligned industry methodology and subsequently data sources to be able to agree to that. So there's just a lot of collaboration and cooperation that is required that we will be very much part of, along with others as well.
Now, Matt, I guess there are a couple of ways to attack this, aren't there? You can either reduce emissions and deal with the infrastructure and the change that you need to achieve fundamental shifts in how you work, or you can offset. Now, is offsetting cheating? Or is there a balance between the two?
Good question. Offsetting is not cheating, but the real challenge ahead of us is to get carbon out of the system. So we need to decarbonize as fast and as far as we can. I think I'd encourage everybody to gear all their efforts to taking carbon out of the system. And I think the sense is that offsetting becomes particularly valuable then for those really challenging emissions that we can't, for whatever reason.
Which are they? Which are those ones that is just, it's really hard to cancel out?
We talk about, you may have heard this phrase, hard to abate sectors. So hard to abate industries are things like steel production, cement production, glass, typically big industrial sectors, also things like aviation, transport. So those do butt up against the food industry when you think about things like packaging, for example, or and the aluminium sector, or transportation systems might be another example. So there will be difficult areas for the food sector to tackle. Some on-farm emissions might be another example of that. Sort of enteric emissions from livestock might be another example where it's very difficult to reduce to zero. I suppose what is encouraging for the food sector is that it's one of the largest land users and one of the most connected to nature. And so there's opportunities to what we call inset. So look for food and drink manufacturers to look in their own value chains at opportunities to capture emissions within agriculture or within nature adjacent to their value chain, which of course then brings all sorts of co-benefits alongside the capturing of carbon. So there's interesting opportunities there. Just to give you another example, carbon capture and utilization might be another area where you could capture a pretty pure carbon dioxide stream out of emissions that then could be used in, say, fizzy drink manufacturer.
There's a real irony right in that, isn't there? Because there's a huge problem with carbon dioxide manufacture at the moment, and as there was last year.
Yeah.
I know that the scale is vastly different, but there's a slight irony to that as well.
Yeah, so there's interesting opportunities there, but the message is we need to get carbon out of the system as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. We talked earlier about the fact that Scope 1 and 2 emissions for food and drink manufacturers, I think according to the modelling, I think you've said is about 6%. So that means, of course, the rest is in the supply chain. So in terms of food and drink manufacturing and the role that they might see for carbon offsets, it is going to be there. And I think particularly, for example, around meat and dairy, there's only going to be so far those emissions can be sort of reduced on site. Mm. On site, you know what I mean? So there will be a role for offsets, and indeed, using that term, insetting, because where you do need to offset, then you should do so within the supply chain. And, you know, this is where, you know, we've talked a lot about working across that farm to fork supply chain. This is a particular area. So the way that manufacturers can engage with their suppliers and helping them is, you know, also understanding some of the ways that those on-site, on-farm emissions could be reduced and working together on those. I think that's going to be really important. And the one other aspect to mention, so the FDF has recently got involved with a new coalition, the Financing UK Nature Coalition. And, you know, this is about increasing biodiversity, looking at the targets, you know, within the Environment Bill around this and restoring nature. And, you know, this is very much about more widely, you know, more than just carbon, about understanding the impact that the food system as a whole can have on the environment, and that we all have a stake, including manufacturers. You know, just because we manufacture the food doesn't mean that we don't have a stake in how those ingredients are produced. You know, and that we can also get involved in that too. So I think it's a very much an evolving picture, and how these mechanisms, how we can invest in restoring nature projects, this is very much evolving, and how that will be used as a sort of as a carbon credit potentially in future. But these are definitely things that we have in mind, and us all working together to achieve it.
Yeah, it strikes me, Emma, that you very cleverly secured your job until at least 2040, because everyone's going to be calling out going, Emma, help me. What's your strategy to help companies? I mean, is it cajoling, encouraging? Is it sort of threatening people? Or are you talking about potential cost benefits? What's the best way to get the message across to industry to make a change?
Do you know, the first phrase that comes to mind is winning hearts and minds. and that applies to everything. From a government perspective, you see, I suppose, two types of approach, you know, a regulatory approach, a mandatory approach, and then a voluntary approach. Now, of course, as with anything, there's going to be roles for both. But, you know, as we're at the, should we say, start of the journey, or just a bit after the start of the journey towards net zero, a lot of what we're doing at the moment, I would say, is probably more on the voluntary stage, should we say, mm-hmm. as the policy and regulatory framework evolves. So, yes, it's about businesses being able to understand, us being able to support businesses in them understanding how this transition could affect them, both in terms of challenges to their existing business models, but also the opportunities it can bring, and more widely, the fact that as a society, we need to build a food system that is resilient, that helps nurture the environment, and that addresses the causes and consequences of climate change. If we don't do those things, then the resiliency of our food system is affected, and that would affect those businesses. So it is about, I think, as a start, painting that picture for stakeholders, understanding their different roles in that system. And then once you've got that and that shared urgency is there, then again, you really build on that sort of stakeholder collaboration from all, you know, both within our sector, as in within food and drink, but also how we relate to other industrial sectors. We'll then all work into that common goal. So there's different stages in that evolving process of what's needed to bring people along.
And if I could just add to that, It would be very unusual to be the CEO of a large food company in the UK now and not be talking to your investors and actually getting very pointed questions from your investors about your plan to decarbonize the business. It would be very unusual to be doing business with large retailers in the UK and not being asked about how you're reducing your carbon emissions through your value chain. And I think almost all food manufacturers in the UK are starting to think about, well, what are the opportunities in this space, as Emma was saying? And the quickest growing segments are those where there's a real carbon-related offer. So it's those novel protein sectors, it's dairy-free milks, it's areas where there's a real carbon benefit to the product. So the conversion's coming very quickly.
And Matt, the work that you're doing, together with 3Kiel are doing on our roadmap, I mean, one of the key outputs, or the key output of that, is, of course, a handbook for businesses, you know, looking at each of those steps of the value chain.
Yeah. And really the intent of the work that FDF is doing with us and 3Kiel is to give a really practical how-to for food and drink companies on the steps that they can take to decarbonize. And I'm very much focused on the short term. So how do we get carbon out of businesses as quickly and efficiently as possible? And how do food businesses manage the risk of that transition, but also deliver on the opportunities for them and their customers and wider stakeholders? So I think I tend to be an optimist in thinking about these things, but I think we're on the cusp of some very, very substantial changes.
And I believe there are some events coming up as part of the roadmap. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, so the publication of the roadmap, the handbook and the supporting documents, that will be at COP26. Now, in the sort of the lead up to COP26, we will be hosting some events online, potentially on some of the various chapters in the lead up, because I think it's very important, as I mentioned earlier, that we continue the momentum around this rather than we launch at COP26 and then we don't hear much afterwards. It's the start, effectively, of a whole new work programme. So, you know, subsequent to the launch, then it will be taking forward the recommendations from each steps of the handbook. So there'll be definitely more to come. But more widely, in terms of the events that we have this year, our 2021 work programme at FDF around net zero is very much based upon research we did towards the end of last year, working with our members and wider manufacturers in the climate change agreement on the kind of support that they needed, the kind of questions, concerns they had around this journey. So some of our programme this year, both in terms of delivering the roadmap, but also in terms of building up knowledge and expertise, sharing of case studies, is something we're progressing this year with, doing a lot of webinars, podcasts with yourselves. You know, it's different engagement points, because I think a key thing for food and drink as well is the fact that when we look at the numbers of businesses, we're talking predominantly SMEs. So the needs of SMEs are going to be quite different. Or should we say their capacity to be able to, you know, filter through this knowledge to get up to speed, is they don't have the same capacity as large multinationals. So, you know, we're very much aiming a lot of the support at them too. And again, we're not alone in that, because of course Bayes very much have that in mind as well, with Andrew Griffiths, MP, Net Zero Business Champion. He's got a particular focus around SMEs and the SME Climate Hub. Work we're doing with Broadway Initiative on zerocarbonbusiness.uk, that website. Again, all this is there to be able to help SMEs in general. And of course, our handbook, as Matt just described, is then specifically for food and drink manufacturers to help them. And we think that will be particularly helpful for SMEs too.
Okay, my last question for both of you really is that change is difficult for the food industry because obviously they have to adapt to ideas, but there's also potential for new processes, new ways of working, new systems. What is it that you're most looking forward to for 2040? Is it the sense that you're doing a good thing, or is there a particular thing? I'm talking about a personal thing rather than a company-wide concept. You know, what is the one bit that you're most excited about once you've achieved net zero? Matt?
It's a really good question. I think the UK, the world, is going to look very different in 2040. And I think that's really exciting. We're on the cusp of just a massive transformation here. So if you think about what a food company looks like today and what we'll need to change as we move to a net zero food company. It's going to mean R&D processes change. Where we target R&D is going to be different. Food products are going to be different. How we sell and how we reach consumers is going to be different. Logistics is going to change. The ingredients we use are going to change. The way we talk and communicate with investors and other stakeholders is going to change. The finance infrastructure, the plumbing around capital investment is going to change. The way we reward CEOs and senior executive teams is going to change. So we're on the cusp of something really, really exciting, I think, in terms of the magnitude of the opportunity and the transformation here.
But Matt, you are cheating. What's the one thing you personally are looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to being able to pick up a net zero food product off a shelf and feel confident that the way I am eating is not contributing to climate change.
I think that sort of sense of change, I think, is really exciting for me as well. Emma, what's the one thing, no cheating like Matt did, what's the one thing you're most excited about achieving net zero by 2040?
It's a bit difficult to follow Matt in that, because I kind of agree with everything he said. I think, given the role that food and drink as a whole sector, you know, has both the importance, obviously, to our society, but the impact it has on the environment. As I mentioned at the start, you know, a quarter of global greenhouse gas emissions come from food. To get to a point in 2040 where we've addressed some of those key challenges of carbon emissions, but also the wider sustainable development points around the world in terms of looking at sustainable development goals of, you know, around hunger and, you know, lots of the challenges that we see. It will be fantastic to see the progress that we've made from that. So I agree with everything Matt has said, so I'm trying to say something kind of additional on top, but that's something that kind of interests me more widely, yeah. I think, as well.
Excellent. Well, you've cheated as well, but I'll allow it.
Thank you.
Emma Pearcey and Matt Lewis, thank you so much for talking to me today. Looking forward to the next 18 years and 167 days and what's going to unfold. So let's talk again before 2040 and find out how it's all going. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry. Some of my recent favourites are I look at the science behind Fuller for Longer Food and also the episode on chrononutrition. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening.